Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Is that a phone in your pocket? Or are you just going to pay me? Why, even the experts don't use their hands to catch catfish. And Priceline brings back the negotiator. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 15th of August. Good to have you here. Consider for just a second the cell phone. You can email, shoot videos, read the paper, get directions, text, and call somebody. A bare-bones list, that is, of what we do with our mobile devices. More and more, though, we're paying for things, too. It's early days yet for mobile payments as a business model, but it's already worth more than $172 billion a year worldwide, which means, everybody wants a slice. So today, more than a dozen big retailers, including the biggest of them all, said they're in. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
Walmart, 7-Eleven, and Target are some of the merchants putting a lot of money where your mouth is. They're part of a group working on a system that would let shoppers pay for things with their phones. Industry consultant Richard Krohn says each store would have its own app.
Siri, open the Target app. Siri, open the Macy's app. So it makes it easy.
When you open the app, the store knows you're there, says Rick Oglesby, a mobile payments analyst for the Aite Group.
A picture of the consumer pops up. It gives the opportunity for the merchant to look up and say, hey, Stacy, it's good to see you. How can I help you today?
Okay, that's creepy. But it's also good for business, says Oglesby. Now the store can look me up and see that I buy a lot of shoes and send a coupon for shoes to my phone. But consultant Deborah Kay isn't so sure consumers will sign on to this. She points out only 11% of us use mobile payments.
Okay, so if I'm in Walmart, I have to know which app to use to pay in the Walmart. If I'm in Starbucks, I have to know which one to use in Starbucks. Is that really more convenient than just pulling out one credit card?
Still, consultant Richard Krohn says consumers could see a financial advantage if they link their shopping app to a personal budget app that helps them track and control spending. Of course, you can always put your budget app on hold, says consultant Deborah Kay.
If you're already at the cash register and you've got this thing that you want to buy and there's a little buzz that says, don't do it, are you going to put it back? I don't think so.
The shoes stay in the basket. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The Department of Agriculture announced the other day that it's going to spend $170 million to buy livestock from farmers who've been hit hard by the drought, pork and chicken mostly, some lamb, and about $10 million worth of catfish. You surprised by that? Yeah, we were too. So we called up Townsend Kaiser. He's a catfish farmer in Greensboro, Alabama. Mr. Kaiser, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Glad to be here.
So $10 million from the USDA. Obviously, you're not going to get all that, but is that going to help you in this drought?
Yes, sir, it is. It's going to help us a lot. It will help our processing industry move a lot more inventory out of the ponds and onto the children's plates who need to eat catfish, need to learn to eat fish twice a week.
What does catfish do to that region down there near Greensboro? I mean, is it a catfish economy?
It is very much a catfish economy. Catfish is the economic engine that drives West Alabama. Most jobs have something to do with the fish business. When the fish business gets tough, you can see it in every business around, from the tire stores to the furniture stores, the grocery stores, Everywhere. There are a lot of jobs associated with the farms, with the processing plants, with the feed mills, and catching, harvesting the fish. It's very important to this area. And this area, you may and may not know, is a economically deprived area in the Black Belt of West Alabama. And catfish is one of the few things helping it to hang on.
Now, what has the drought done to you, Mr. Kaiser? I mean, how bad's it been?
It's been pretty bad. Our ponds are showing signs of a lot of evaporation and no rain. It is also driving the price of grain up, which Feed is our biggest input.
Is that what you feed catfish? You feed them grain?
Yes, sir. It's an extremely expensive diet. And right now we're getting about 65 to 70 cents a pound. And with the cost of grain where it is, it costs about 90 cents to raise them. So the catfish industry is in a pretty rough spot right now.
Yeah, that's kind of backwards, right?
Yes, sir, it is.
What happens to you, Mr. Kaiser, if this drought goes on? I mean, you know, the USDA is only going to buy so much catfish.
That's right. I don't know. We will keep forging ahead. I've got 18 employees that look at me every day to help them provide for their families, and we're going to keep doing the best that we can.
Is the USDA's purchase enough for you? I mean, is that going to get you over until the rain starts again?
I hope it does. It's certainly a start. People need to start eating a lot more fish and take in mind where their seafood comes from as well.
Listen, one more thing that I have to ask you, just because it's been in the news after Paul Ryan got selected by Governor Romney. What is this whole noodling thing that people do with catfish? What is that about?
That's some crazy guys going to have some fun. I've never done it. I'd be scared to stick my hand in a hole like that.
Yeah, because those guys bite, right?
They do.
All right. Townsend Kaiser, he's in Greensboro, Alabama, raising catfish. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate your interest in agriculture and the fish business in particular.
You betcha.
Thank you, bud.
Starting today, undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children have a way to stay here a little bit longer, legally. Best guesses are almost 2 million people could be eligible for what's called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Initiative. Once they file the right paperwork and pay a fee of $465, qualified applicants get a renewable work permit, good for 2 years, which sounds like a bargain. But Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports not everybody thinks so.
Many who qualify for the Deferred Action Program are taking a wait-and-see approach. Eric Huerta was 7 when his parents brought him to this country. Now he's 28 and studying journalism at a college in East Los Angeles. He's eligible for the program, but in an election year, he worries the rules could change. And he fears that information gathered now could one day be used to deport him.
Having friends who have had parents deported, having friends deported, I know differently how things work on paper and how things are executed. Are two completely different things.
Robert Ratliff is an immigration attorney in Mobile, Alabama. He says his clients have two concerns.
One is that it's a two-year program and they don't know what's going to happen at the end of 2 years. And two, by applying for this program, are they exposing their family and other maybe non-qualifying siblings to the government?
The application process can be complicated, and Ratliff says it's not for everyone.
Everyone needs to consult an attorney or a licensed immigration representative to really see if this is the right program for them.
But consulting a lawyer means another expense. Ratliff charges between $300 and $2,000, depending on the complexity of the case. And for applicants like Eric Huerta, even the $465 application fee is a challenge.
It's not exactly chump change, and that's not something I have in the bank right now. I'm a student. I'm unemployed.
Many others are in the same boat. To raise money for the application fee, Huerta says some communities are holding fundraisers or yard sales. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You know, traders keep going to work. I can see them there on the TV, but the major indices just aren't going anywhere. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'll start the setup of this next story by noting that Elvis died 35 years ago tomorrow, and that there are people out there, in the absence of concrete proof to the contrary, who believe he's still with us. So with that as a pivot point, we turn now to Priceline and William Shatner. Shatner, as you may know, played the Priceline negotiator in the company's television ads for years until they killed him off in a fiery bus crash in an ad back in January. Or so we thought. Now, conveniently, just as Priceline is hitting a rough patch, Shatner's back in a new ad airing this week. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
You've been busy for a dead man. After you jumped ship in Bangkok, I thought I'd lost you.
Surfing is my life now.
So he survived a bus crash and took up surfing? The new ad set on a beach doesn't offer much explanation of how the negotiator escaped death. Priceline's Brian Eck says the company always kept the door open for a Shatner comeback.
When he went off the cliff in the bus, you actually didn't see him. So there was just that little bit of doubt, and it was intentional.
At the time, Priceline was focused less on customers naming their price and more on getting them to book hotels and flights at fixed rates, just like Orbitz and Expedia. So Priceline emphasized that by ending Shatner's negotiator character. Michigan State advertising professor Salim Al-Habash was surprised. It's unusual for companies to toss away a valuable frontman.
We want to listen to stories, and if ads can really create a character, then I'm definitely going to remember the brand and have a positive response toward that ad and the brand as well.
Whether it's Travelocity's Gnome, Geico's Gecko, or Flo, who hawks insurance for Progressive, strong characters can make something as boring as a travel website or insurance company sound interesting. Gary Wilcox is an advertising professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
All those things are endearing and bring a personality to the brand that normally they wouldn't have.
So it's no surprise that Shatner's character is cheating death, soap opera style. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, putting mom on the payroll.
I know that she's always got my best interests at heart. And if my best interest is the company's best interest, then I know that she's going to root for that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, looky there, another cautious day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 7 points today, basically flat, 13,164. The NASDAQ rose almost 0.5%, 13 points, 3,030, the number there. The S&P 500 put on 0.1%, 1 point, finished at 1,405. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley had a strong day on Wall Street, each added 1%. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup all lost around 0.1% today. Farm equipment maker Deere plowed under 6% after falling short of expectations and lowering its forecast. Caterpillar inched down 0.3%. Cisco Systems up 1% today. United Technologies did almost as well, added nearly 1%. Abercrombie & Fitch, the teen apparel retailer, climbed 9% on better-than-expected earnings. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. Think about that. Where it used to be, 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for July. Batter up, the Little League Baseball World Series gets underway in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And on August 16, 1920, poet Charles Bukowski was born. Among his popular works, the screenplay for Barfly. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in 2000, a young producer named Walter Latham took film that he'd shot of four African-American comedians, big names, too, guys like Bernie Mac and D.L. Hughley, and he turned it into a hit movie directed by Spike Lee called The Original Kings of Comedy. The thing made $30 million. And now, 12 years, more comedians and millions more dollars later, Walter Latham has taken his business online. He's going to start a new YouTube comedy channel. Walter Latham, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
You've been around comedy for a while. You know what you're doing. You've had a whole bunch of hits. Why then choose YouTube?
It's a different era that we're in. You know, everyone is going to the internet. And for me, it's great, you know, in the industry that I'm in, whether it's television or film, you have to convince another person that what you're trying to do makes sense. Whereas on YouTube, I just do whatever I want
to
do.
It doesn't have to make sense.
It doesn't have to make sense.
Now, obviously, you have other sources of income that you can use to pay these guys. Mm-hmm. But how do you make money on a YouTube channel that people can watch for free? Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it right now. You've got 10,032 subscribers.
Right.
How does that translate into revenue for you?
Well, the revenue comes from the views, and it comes from advertising relationships. And, you know, what YouTube was able to do for me is go out and align us with, I don't think we can announce it yet, but align us with a pretty big advertiser who would pay to be aligned with our channel. So we're going to make money. It's just, I can't say it yet, but yeah, we're going to definitely make money.
Are you all right with this being known as a black YouTube
Absolutely.
Channel?
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with it, and black transcends all color now. Rap, Jay-Z is black, I think, the last time I checked, and Kanye West is too. But I doubt they're rich yes, because they only black people are buying their music. So I'm A-OK with it. A-OK.
How big do you think this could be? I mean, obviously you've got ambition, but what's the realistic ambition?
The realistic ambition is that cable is going to go away. And, you know, we are here now in the early stages of what cable was probably 30 years ago. And that BET, although they had their shot, I think they could have done better. We're going to do better. And in, you know, 30 years from now, we'll be looked at as the better version of BET, but on internet as opposed to cable.
You know, it's funny because we had the CEO of BET on the show maybe 6 weeks or so ago, and she seemed pretty confident that she was going to hang on to
I love Deborah. You know? She's cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and you know, she has to say that. She can't say anything different. But I can guarantee you, is no way for them to stay alive that they're not looking at a way to also get into this platform. You can't survive without it. I mean, because that's just the way people want it. I mean, cable is too long. it's too slow, believe it or not. And I'm a 42-year-old guy, so to me, cable is fine. But
but what about your kids?
I have a 14-year-old who tells me cable's not fine. So dad, you know, I go in his room. He has his TV on, but he's not looking at it. He's laying on the floor with his laptop and his. I don't even know how he does this. He like lays on his back, his feet are up, and his laptop is kind of hanging above him, and he's just on YouTube, you know, surfing the web constantly all day. Yeah. That's what he does.
If you had an opportunity now to do another Kings of Comedy like thing, right? If you could find some vehicle that you wanted to make an actual motion picture out of, would you do it as a motion picture in theaters, or would you throw it up on YouTube?
I think right now I would do it as a motion picture, only because I understand the economics of that even now. You know, if you make a $3 million picture, you release it as a motion picture, you're gonna make money. But that's not to say if you made that same picture for $1 million and was able to get, you know, I don't know, a sponsor to step up or two sponsors to step up with $20 or $30 million to be a part of it, and you streamed it on YouTube one night for the whole audience, that might make sense.
You are in North Carolina, not necessarily the entertainment capital of the world. Can you run this network from there?
The funny thing, I can run it from my house. You know, the cool thing about this is as long as you have your content on a hard drive and you have a really cool computer with really fast internet access, you can run it from anywhere in the world.
Walter Latham of Latham Entertainment and the Latham Comedy Channel on YouTube. Thanks very much for your time, Walter.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so I'll tell you, this is looking to be a tricky week for some newly minted public companies. Shares of Angie's List, the consumer review site that had its IPO in November, tumbled nearly 16% yesterday after its lockups expired. I know. Right about now you're saying, what's a lockup, Kai? Well, we'll tell you right after we mention that the lockup for Facebook, an oh-so-much-more famous freshly public company, ends tomorrow. Here's Queen of Kim with our lockup explainer.
On the day a company goes public, insiders, like employees and early investors, are not allowed to sell their stock. Their shares are locked up for anywhere from 90 days to a year. Tomorrow, the first of Facebook's stock restrictions expires. James Angel is a professor at Georgetown University's business school.
This is the moment of truth.
Facebook trades at about 70% of what it earns. Simply put, that means investors are betting that Facebook will make 70 times more than it does now. Angel says tomorrow, insiders will signal whether Facebook's going to hit that target anytime soon.
If they dump their shares as fast as possible, that says one thing.
It says people in the know don't think the company is growing fast enough. But if lots of insiders don't sell,
that sends a good signal.
It says Facebook's going to live up to expectation, and the stock price will keep moving up. Peter Wendell is the managing director of the venture capital firm Sierra Ventures. He says people read too much into lockups. If you look at the last 100 companies on the day their lockups expired,
I bet you 90 times out of 100, the price would be down that day.
Wendell's point, insiders will sell and Facebook stock will fall. Wendell says in volatile sectors like social media, it's not uncommon for a stock to fall up to 10% on the day a lockup expires. And that's not necessarily a no-confidence vote. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Some numbers out earlier this week from the central bank in Beijing suggests more and more Chinese investors are starting to take their money out of the country. Where's the money going? From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has the details.
Hong Kong, Canada, Australia, and yes, the United States. These are now among the top destinations for Chinese investors' money. Janet Zhang is an economist in Beijing at the research firm GK Dragonomics. She says it all started when China's currency, the renminbi, began to depreciate at the beginning of the year. U.S. dollars started looking good.
So the domestic enterprises and individuals
began to change their cash into USD instead of renminbi.
More than any time in the last 5 years, wealthy Chinese are moving their money abroad. Sean Ryan is the author of The End of Cheap China and managing director of China Market Research Group.
The days where China is going to be growing 10-12% a year are fairly limited. And so people are now looking for diversification of income streams. You know, for instance, I recently interviewed one of the largest real estate developers in China, and he's now looking at building more complexes in Taiwan and in the United States because he thinks that he's just not going to get the returns in China that he's enjoyed over the last decade.
Ryan says rich Chinese investors aren't only moving their money to the U.S., they're moving themselves and their children out of China, too. Pollution, dismal health care, and a weak education system are pushing them out just as much as a sinking currency. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Used to be that going into the family business meant a dad because it was usually a dad, right? Hiring his kids, Steinway and Sons, that sort of thing. But some young entrepreneurs out there are turning that idea on its head. They're hiring their parents to staff up their startups. From New York, Ashley Montite has that story.
The studio where Alexandra Ferguson runs her home decor business is buzzing. Ferguson started her company in New Rochelle, New York in 2009. She designs pillows with phrases like think big and be nice or leave emblazoned on the front. The room is full of bolts of blue, pink and red felt and trays of individually cut letters waiting to be sewn onto the pillows.
So the logo goes there, and then it has the care content label inside. This one is the good life.
Ferguson's mum, Charlotte, works for her 15 to 20 hours a week. For now, she's unpaid, but Ferguson says when they eventually divide up equity in the company, her mum will receive a large chunk. They're not sure how much yet. There's no one she trusts more.
I know that she's always got my best interests at heart, and if my best interest is the company's best interest, then I know that she's going to root for that. There's no ulterior motive for her except what's going to be good for me.
So what's it like for Charlotte having her daughter as her boss?
Very strange.
Charlotte says she's the practical one, getting things done behind the scenes. She offers moral support and in typical mum fashion, even tells her boss when her skirt's too short. She says she's glad to let her daughter shine.
She should do. I mean, she's the front face of the company, but I'm happy to be behind and help her. Sometimes, you know, I feel like, I don't really want to do that.
But she usually obliges. If only every child-parent business partnership were so functional. Wayne Rivers is president of the Family Business Institute, a consultancy. His company once advised a business owner who had hired her father.
Unfortunately, Dad had a wandering eye, and of course his daughter didn't know this until one day when she caught him, sort of in the act with the office manager.
The daughter told her father he was fired, as she would any other employee in the same compromising position. But Dad refused to go, citing his parental authority, among other things. Rivers says parents often think the usual rules don't apply to them. He says both parties tend to think the business relationship will work because they love each other.
We don't need a job description, and we don't need accountability policies, and we don't need this, and we don't need that, because love will be enough. It's not.
He says pre-hire planning is key. Katie Wyford and her mother, Sheila, have done a little of that. They're opening Cookie Doodle Crafts in Kansas City in September. They're splitting the business 50-50, even though it was Katie's brainchild. Katie says, somewhat to her frustration, she's doing more work than her mom for one reason.
In starting a new business in this day and age, a lot of what you have to do involves technology.
That isn't her mother's strongest area.
I do detect some frustration in her voice.
But then again, Sheila says, modestly, she does have other strengths. Katie agrees. She says while she multitasks madly, her mother has a different approach to business.
She takes one thing at a time and really puts all of her energy into getting one thing done correctly. And I think, especially with our vendors, they appreciate that.
But their relationship is going through some changes. Sheila says they're mostly good.
She's learning new things about me, and I certainly am learning new things about her every day.
But Katie says sometimes things get emotional, and when she gets exasperated at something, she has to remind her mum she's irritated with her business partner, not her mother. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which social media gets a little bit real. Maybe you've heard of clout. It purports to tell you how much influence you have online using some magical mystery algorithm with 400 variables in it, boiling everything down into a single score between 1 and 100. There are skeptics, you might rightly guess, yours truly included. President Obama had a 94. Justin Bieber at a 100. Well, the news is they changed their algorithm today over at Clout. Bieber's at 92. Obama's up to 99. Here's the best part. The new algorithm they're using uses Wikipedia to help them figure out what to do. And no, I have no idea what my Clout score is. Speaking of Clout and social media, we heard from quite a few of you on our conversation yesterday about that listener who tweeted that she paid her kid $20 to read The Odyssey. A lot of you, not fans of that approach. A typical response went like this, quote, bottom line, read with your kids. Don't pay them to read. It's a better investment. Investments on Wall Street today? Not so good. The Dow off 7 points, a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 13 points, almost a half percent. The S&P 500 up a point, a little over a tenth of 1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lentz, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.